And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and whoever else we have come on here that's involved in publishing, discussing the art and the business of writing. And I should also say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show today and every day are those of me and my guest, and not of the University of California Regents. Today my guest is Laura Littman, author of Every Secret Thing, published by William Morrow. Laura Littman was a reporter for the Baltimore Sun for 12 years. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Slate.com, and her seven novels have been awarded every major prize in crime fiction. She is the recipient of the first Mayor's Prize for Literary Excellence, where she lives, in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you on. Will you please tell our listeners what inspired Every Secret Thing? It's such a departure from your Tess Monahan series, and I wonder if you'd talk about that.
Sure, I'm glad to. There was one specific incident that inspired the book, and it happened when I was traveling in England in the fall of 2000. It was then that a judge was asked to rule about two young men who, as very young children, 10-year-olds, had killed a toddler known as Jamie Bulger. And they were coming to their end of their time in juvenile facilities, and the judge was asked if they could be moved to adult facilities, if they could serve longer sentences given how horrific their crime was. And there was a lot of popular support for this. And he came back and said no, he was going to release them at the end of their juvenile terms, and that was proper, that if we didn't believe that 10-year-olds deserved to be in the juvenile system, then who was it for? And that furthermore, when he did release them, they would have new names and new national identity numbers, and there would be a strict injunction against ever revealing who they were or where they were. And the first thought that went zinging through my mind is, well, that would be quite impossible in the United States.
Mm. It sure would, huh?
Press law being quite different here.
Yes, yes. Is that how your books begin? Do they tend to begin with an incident, or do they begin all different ways?
Most of them, if I look at the eight books I've published and now the ninth book that I've finished and sent off to my publisher this week, have in fact been inspired by some true life event that I've then twisted in my head to say, what if?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's usually some little nugget of reality in there, but by the time it's been through whatever process I put it through, it's come out quite different.
Yes. Hmm. So, Every Secret Thing is a multiple point of view novel in the third person, and the Tess Monahan series, as I recall, is a close third. You're very much in
yes.
Tess's shoes. Will you talk about why you chose that form for this book?
Well, you know, originally when I had the idea, the first thought was, could this be a Tess Monahan novel? And I didn't see how it could be, because I think the point of writing about this kind of crime, about this kind of story, is to take advantage of fiction, which sometimes can do something that nonfiction can't do or hasn't done. And what I think most people want to know in a crime involving very young perpetrators is, why did they do it? How could they do it? And I couldn't answer those questions if I didn't avail myself of the point of view of the two girls, the two 11-year-old girls in this book who have killed, well, they've killed a baby. Sometimes I say child because I'm embarrassed about how stark and awful it sounds. But the fact is they have, at the age of 11, killed a 9-month-old baby. And this is about what happens when they return home at the age of 18, 7 years later. And I read some books, some true accounts, particularly a fascinating book about a woman known as Mary Bell. Mary Bell was a girl in England who, with a neighbor child, killed two other children. And she was one of the most notorious young criminals in the history of modern history of England. And the journalist who covered her trial found her as an adult and wrote a really interesting and wonderful book But even in such a well-reported and well-observed book, she could not tell us why Mary Bell did the things she did, because Mary Bell could not tell us. And it occurred to me that normal people, i.e. not sociopaths, who killed when they were young, in order to survive would have to lose a lot of their memories, would have to distance themselves from what they had done, and so therefore would probably never be able to really provide satisfactory explanations. But, you know, in a novel, I don't think it's arrogant or hubristic to say that if you spend a lot of time on the characters that you've created, that they can lead you to some things that they can't claim to be universal truths, but they're certainly plausible. I think this was an opportunity. I was trying to come up with just a perfectly plausible way that two seemingly normal girls could do something so horrible. And to do that, I had to write from many points of view, and I had to show not only how they were affected, but also how the mother of their victim was affected, and one of the girls' own mothers, and, you know, professionals, police officers and lawyers and the like, who were also drawn into this story.
So how much did you know about every secret thing before you began it? Did you plot it out? Did you outline it? Did you spend weeks just working on how the story was going to unfold?
I knew shockingly little. It's almost a little embarrassing to admit this, because I know from having talked to a lot of readers that the book reads as if it were plotted in a very detailed way. I set up the situation, and I knew the situation. Two girls had killed a baby. Now they were coming home, and that was upsetting to any number of people. And I needed to work from that setup to what I thought would be what I'll call an organic solution. I knew that something would happen that would bring attention to them, that would threaten to basically undo the whole new start they were being given. And I knew that at least one of the girls had to be innocent in the present, if not in the past. But there was a lot I didn't know, and there was a lot I didn't figure out for a while. And it grew out of many drafts. So the book, as it is between covers, is really probably a fifth or sixth draft. And a lot of the story came through the drafting process.
I find that encouraging, actually, because especially with, the mystery suspense genre or crime genre, where so many authors will say, no, you have to plot it out so that you don't get lost on page 200, so that you know where you're going and what's going to happen. And I like that this unfolded like that for you.
I think that there are no hard and fast rules. I'm frequently surprised when I hear fellow writers say that they've started books and they don't have a clue who did it or why they did it. But for the most part, anything that works.
Yeah, that's true. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I am here today with Laura Lippman, author of Every Secret Thing, published by William Morrow. Baltimore is such a setting. It's so vivid in your writing, and so I'm curious about that. It's almost at times like a character, and I wonder if that's important to you, and if that's even intentional.
Very intentional. I think of Baltimore in some ways as, and it sounds kind of corny, but I think of Baltimore as the love of my life. It's certainly the thing I've had the longest sustained relationship with as an adult. And I never cease to find it less than fascinating. I am happy just wandering the streets, listening to people speak to each other and eavesdropping. The city strikes me as not as a unique place than, certainly a peculiar one. It's a place that's often defined by what it's not. People who move here from the true South will say, well, it's not a Southern city. But people who come down from New York or New Jersey say, well, it's definitely not a Northern city. there's an impression, there's a general belief that it's very much a blue-collar city, and yet the city's largest employer is, I believe, the Johns Hopkins University and Hospital System. Mm-hmm. That's outside of also state and federal and city government that employ a lot of workers. And it's just a place where there are endless contradictions. You know, a lot of Baltimore's reputation has been established by some really nostalgic work. And that nostalgic work is true. But I always remember being really struck sitting in the newsroom at the Baltimore Sun one day, listening to two of my colleagues who were African American talking about Thurgood Marshall's Baltimore, because he grew up here,
mm-hmm.
and saying, you know, Thurgood Marshall isn't walking around talking about what a great, charming place it was and how everybody called him hon. And I just thought, that's really vital. It's, you know, there's so many different versions of the city in growing up here, and I don't think anyone can master it. You can nail pieces of it. You might be able to get a decade here or there that belongs to you. But the city as a whole is just a really unwieldy subject. So I feel as if I'm never going to run out of things to say about it. And I just feel as if I'm never going to get tired of living here.
Had you ever considered leaving?
Well, I did leave, sort of. I left to go away to college, and that was very much my decision. But then as soon as I got out of college, I wanted to come home. But very hard to get a job in a newspaper in Baltimore when you're 22. So I had to go to Texas. And I ended up spending 8 years in Texas. And I'm glad I did. I think it was good. I think that I would have been somewhat of an incurious reporter if I'd started off in my hometown, and going to a place that was very different made me a better reporter. And I've traveled a lot, and there are a lot of places that I love, and there are places I could imagine myself living for 3 months here or there. But I just can't see myself living for any lengthy period of time anywhere but Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were a newspaper reporter for 20 years?
20 years.
How has that experience influenced your fiction? What's the carryover? You know, what have you brought from it?
One of the more surprising things I've brought from journalism is what I'll call a healthy disrespect for research. I find that the writers who are really caught up in research tend not to have a journalism background. And they take it a lot more seriously than I do. And some of them write absolutely fantastic books. And their books are really riveting for all of the knowledge in them. But, you know, that's what I wanted to leave behind, is I wanted the freedom of writing a plausible story as opposed to writing accurate stories.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I know how to find something out when I need to, and I can do it very quickly and efficiently. So that's one of the things I brought from journalism. The details about the physical workings of the Baltimore County Police Department in Every Secret Thing are actually reported. And the elevators are truly slow, and they really did put the lab on the top floor in case it ever blew up. I certainly brought discipline. You know, one thing about being a reporter is that you don't get to wait until your inspiration shows up.
Yeah.
Your copy is due when it's due, and if you miss deadline, you failed.
Yes.
You know, and that was very good training. People ask me about writer's block, and I say, I don't actually believe in it. I don't. Are there days when I can't write particularly well, or I can't seem to move forward in the book at hand? Yes. But there's never a day I can't write. I would say, you know, especially with the advent of email, I wonder if a day goes by when I don't write something.
Right.
I write every day. I write all the time. If I don't literally have my laptop in front of me, I'll probably be writing in my head. It's just what I do. You know, part of being a reporter is that when you're out on assignment, you're writing the story in your head. You have to do that to be fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of those things came from journalism. But you know, journalism also makes the world a very accessible place. And you realize if there's anything you really need to understand, you probably can. And it's just a matter of figuring out which person to get on the phone to help you start.
Yeah. Interesting. Will you read to us?
Yes, I will.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I am here today with Laura Lippman. She's about to read from Every Secret Thing.
Now, should I set up what I'm reading in any way? Because it needs a little bit of explanation.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
I am reading from one of the early chapters of the book. I'm reading a section in which Cynthia Barnes, a woman who lost a child to a horrible homicide 7 years ago, has found out that the perpetrators are being released now, that their time in juvenile facilities is up, and they will be returning home, and home is not very far from her home. And this has made her understandably nervous and anxious. And the first thing she wants to do is go home and see her other child, a child that was born subsequent to the homicide of her sister Olivia. And I'll begin now.
Okay.
Rosalind sat on the floor, eyes locked on Sleeping Beauty, singing along in a breathy baby voice. She was such an easy baby, had been from the first, and had passed through the so-called terrible twos with barely a tantrum. She'd never known colic, which had troubled Olivia so, and she was seldom stricken with so much as a cold. Well, a child breastfed until the age of two had advantages when it came to immunities. Now, Rosalind had come out shockingly light and stayed that way, a trick of the blood that Cynthia's mother claimed for her family tree, although Cynthia knew there wasn't a fair-skinned ancestor in the bunch. No one knew what to make of the amazing hair, which hung in amber ringlets. Her eyes, however, were brown, like almost everyone else in the Poole and Barnes clans. Olivia had gotten the green eyes of this generation, and family legend held that only one child would have green eyes. "Who dat baby?" Rosalind had asked a few weeks ago, noticing for the first time the photograph in a small oval frame on Cynthia's dressing table. "Who dat?" "Who dat, indeed." Cynthia and Warren had known that they would have to tell Rosalind one day, but it never occurred to them that a toddler would initiate the conversation with such a basic existential question. "Who's that?" "She was your sister." "Except she wasn't, because you and she never existed in the same plane. She's nothing to you, and never will be. And if she had not died, you might not exist, because your mother had specific plans for her life, and having a baby at age 41 was not one of them." Rosalind was satisfied with the simplest truth. "Olivia." She repeated the name, patted the photo, and promptly forgot about it. All Rosalind wanted was a way to categorize and identify. That is a cow, and that is a dog, and that is Olivia. The cow goes moo, and the dog goes bow-wow, and Olivia goes, "Livy." Her first word, her only word, uttered a few days before she was taken. They had joked about it at the time, how the daughter was just like her mother, sure of her place at the center of the universe, or only a few inches to the left. Now Cynthia couldn't help thinking it was as if Olivia knew she might never get to say her name otherwise. On the video, the bad fairy was throwing a fit over her missing invitation. Uninvited, sent home early. It all ends the same way, doesn't it? The bad fairy reminded Cynthia not of Alice and Ronnie, the two girls who had taken Olivia, but of Sharon, their lawyer, and their last face-to-face meeting outside Columbia Mall summer before last. Cynthia had been struggling with Rosalind's carriage, a European model that was a pain in the butt, so heavy, so not portable, so impossible for any 11-year-old to roll away. Sharon had stood, hands empty, chattering away, never offering to help. "Did Cynthia miss City Hall? What did she think of the new mayor? Sharon had finally given up, moved to the suburbs, just to have the security of knowing she had a place to park after a long day. Was that so much to ask? Did that make her a hypocrite?" Then that obtuse woman had leaned into the carriage and uttered her own form of a curse. "Why, Cynthia, I didn't know you had a baby to replace Olivia." The minute the words were out, even insensitive Sharon realized she had gone too far. Her cheeks burned red and a rush of blood so bright that it washed out the odd markings on the left side of her face. She scurried away, making excuses. Not a week later, a reporter called, her voice round with fake empathy, asking Cynthia if she wanted to tell the Beacon Lights readers about this bittersweet happy ending, about her triumphant second act, those had been the reporter's words, to let Baltimoreans know how Cynthia and Warren had recovered from their horrible, horrible tragedy. Those had been her exact words, too. Horrible, horrible. As if repeating the word would prove that she really understood Cynthia's plight. And that was the reporter's term as well. Plight. Cynthia wasn't fooled. She was a freak. The mother of the replacement baby. The idiot who had moved back into the same trailer park after a tornado tossed her first mobile home. They wanted to put her on parade so the paper's readers would feel safe and secure. Their babies would never be stolen. Their babies would never be killed. Because Cynthia Barnes had taken the fall for all of them.
Oh, thank you very much. That was Laura Lippman reading from Every Secret Thing. Oh, boy. I wanted to ask you about the tone, or the voice, I suppose. This book is rather dark, and Tess Monahan, that series is, kind of bright, kind of jumpy, kind of fun, actually.
I agree.
What was it like, or how did you go from that to this? Because you have quite a few books of that series and that character and writing in that voice, and now to write in this voice. What did you have to go through?
Even within the Tess series, there's been a less dramatic shift in tone from book to book, depending on the subject. Some Tess books are much lighter than others. In a Strange City, it's very frothy and, good humor compared to The Last Place, which followed it, which is fairly dark and has one of the most violent scenes I've ever written. With this book, I always joke, but it's not a joke, it's just true. It began as a series of monologues in which women sat at their breakfast tables, drank coffee, and thought about their lives. And what I was doing that I didn't know that I was doing at the time was just sort of gathering intelligence about my own characters and letting them tell me their stories and find their voices and understand who they were. In hindsight, it seems to have come very naturally, but I'm suspicious of my hindsight. I think it was more difficult than I remember, and that sometimes writers block out how hard stuff is so they can do it again. So I've heard it compared to labor. You have to forget what it's like in order to have another child. I spent a lot of time just thinking. When I was at the newspaper, I always felt there was a kind of disdain within journalism, newspaper journalism in particular, for thinking, and a building has blown up or there's some breaking news event and the response is run, 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 go, go, go. And sometimes it's good to just sit and think for 3 minutes about what you want to do and how you want to do it. If you just sat at your desk staring into space and the boss walked by, you would look like you were a slacker. But I felt that it helped to think. And I did a lot of thinking about this book. And it was probably on my mind most of my waking hours during the time I was writing it. And although I would only spend 3 to 4 hours a day in the physical activity of writing, I was constantly thinking about these women. Who would they be? Where would they be from? Where would they grow up? What were they listening to on the radio? What would they drink? What would they eat? And bit by bit, the portraits assembled themselves. And once I knew the characters, I found I could write in their voices. And I think the book is dark because with that setup, how could it be anything but?
Yes. Interesting. Let's take a real brief break. We will be right back with more Laura Lippman. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right here. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here today with Laura Lippman. And before we go on, let me once again say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California Regents. Oh, boy. Curious about, well, you had mentioned the beginning just a few minutes ago at Laura's, beginning as monologues. And so I'm curious about the beginning here, the first sentence. Let me find it.
I can almost recite
it. Okay, go ahead.
They were barefoot when they left.
Yes.
And that image is almost as old as the idea for the book. I can't remember not having that image, and I've actually gone through, I'm actually somewhat systematic about my writing files. It's easy to do on computer, and I keep each version of a book in a folder numbered as I go through draft after draft. And I do that in part because whenever I'm stuck or having a bad day, I simply go and see where I was a year ago today, and I'm always immensely cheered to find out how lost and out of my mind I was usually a year earlier at the same time. It always reminds me that each book is survivable. But in this case, I know from the very beginning that that these two little girls were walking home from a swim club, and I had the image of a wet footprint evaporating almost instantly as you walk down a hot sidewalk. And, you know, of course, it's pretty obvious what's happening, what's disappearing. I mean, this is the last walk that Alice and Ronnie will take as innocent children. And by the end of this walk, they will be losing their childhood, or they will have taken the first step toward losing their childhood. I also wanted to do something a little bit sneaky, which is that I didn't mind if some readers started reading this book and thought that something really horrible was going to happen to the two 11-year-old girls they were reading about, because I knew where I was going with the story. And I thought if people get to the point where they realize that the two little girls they're following are not going to be victims, but are in fact going to be perpetrators, that if the reader was really honest with himself or herself, the reader should say, well, if I was willing to read a book that began with what might have been the rape and murder of two 11-year-olds, I guess it would be hypocritical for me to drop out because it turns out to be the murder of a smaller child. And so all of those thoughts went into the prologue.
Interesting. Hmm. Oh, well, will you talk about why you chose the crime genre?
I wrote my first crime novel. This is serious. It's really because I wanted to kill somebody. a friend had a boss who was very mean and very cranky and had been extremely rude to me under circumstances that I thought made his rudeness quite inappropriate. And I said to my friend off the cuff, you know, someday someone's going to kill your boss and they're going to be so many suspects, they'll never sort it out. And that really led to the first Tess Monahan novel, Baltimore Blues. I had grown up watching Perry Mason with my grandfather, and I think that was actually a big influence, and had read a lot of hard-boiled fiction. But really, I think the reason I began writing crime novels is because I had had trouble finishing work. I would start things and they wouldn't go anywhere. And writing something that was really story-driven seemed to solve that problem. And I really liked crime novels. I certainly had read enough of them, and I, you know, never thought of myself as slumming when I was reading James Cain or Raymond Chandler. And then as I began reading some of the newer people on the scene, like Sarah Paretsky and Walter Mosley and Carl Hyacin, I couldn't see how writing that kind of fiction was any less of an achievement than mainstream fiction. Mm-hmm. I love these books, and all of those things coalesced into me trying a crime novel my first time out, and I finally did finish. It did do what I wanted it to do, is it convinced me to finish.
Did you plot that?
Not exactly. I knew I had a very definite idea. I actually wanted to do an anti-Perry Mason. In the Perry Masons that I watched with my grandfather as a kid, it always seemed to me as if the people who were killed were very evil, and there would be a whole bunch of people who wanted to kill them. And my idea was simply that I wanted to write about a person who did have a lot of enemies and had done a lot of really rotten things to people, but the twist would turn out that he would be killed for something he had done that most people would see is actually fairly good, but for someone else, it had seemed really harmful. And so the idea of a bad guy being killed for one of the few good things he ever did in his life seemed ironic to me. And that was about as much as I'd thought it out. I tend to begin with scenarios, and I sort of know where the book is going, but especially when I'm writing a Tess Monahan book, I just think, okay, what would Tess do next? You know, what does she know right now? Where is she going to go to find out something? And I just follow her.
Hmm. Yeah, it's all encouraging that you're not a heavy plotter, actually, because I have a lot of students who are insecure at times because they don't really know where they're going. It's like, just take one footstep at a time here. Just keep going. You know?
If you're willing to do a lot of drafts, and I am, you can back your way into a pretty well-constructed plot. A lot of people are terrified of rewrites. And you asked earlier about the journalism background. The journalism background is so helpful in terms of freeing you from the fear of having to start completely over again.
Mm-hmm.
If you've worked at a newspaper, chances are you've done a medium to lengthy feature that you've turned in and have had turned back to you, and it's almost like it's a fish that's been deboned. Like, oh my God. And it's essentially you have to do it over. You know, you've got the lead in the middle, and the middle is the end, and the end is just, you know, and you just redo this. You've got to rethink it. But once you've done that a couple of times, you realize it's survivable. And plots are not that hard to fix if you're willing to just work them over and over again. And I like going through draft after draft after draft until, you know, by the time I'm on my fourth draft of something, I've got a really good grasp of the story that I started with.
Hmm.
And I know everything about it, but not until that fourth draft.
So do you tweak as you go along, or do you just keep going? And if things occur to you to change, you make notes, but you just keep going.
I think you should try to barrel through the first draft. I believe Steinbeck said that. I won't swear to it, but I do think that was his advice. Just get through the first draft no matter what. I once had a character change gender halfway through a manuscript. And I just said, that's okay, I'll go back for it in draft two. I do think computers are wonderful. I wouldn't work without one. But they can really screw you up if you're a perfectionist, because they make it easy to be a perfectionist, and you could just spend forever on chapter one going back into it every day and changing this word and that word. So my rule is to barrel through and to just go from point A to point Z over and over again.
So what if, then, you begin something and chapter three you decide that your main character isn't a male, but a female. Would you keep going from that with the new gender and just not even go back? Don't even mess with it.
That's what I would do. And mm-hmm. I'd know that I'd get it the next time around, and that by the time I came back around to those early chapters, not only would I have the right gender for my character, but I'd have other information as well that, having gotten through the draft, would have been a learning experience about all the characters. And so with each subsequent draft, the characters are sharper and, I hope, more real to life.
Mm-hmm. That's good. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Laura Lippman, author of Every Secret Thing, published by William Morrow. Love the cover, too. Covers are so important.
Yeah, they are extremely important.
Do you have anything to do with this one?
Not
Did they
much.
Show you?
I'm not a real visual person, and it's often hard for me when they ask me for my ideas about how to illustrate a book. And Every Secret Thing was especially hard. I was actually proud of the fact that in the book, they, for chapter headings and section headings. They use a kid print font, and that was my idea. It's one of the few visual ideas I've ever had, and when I turned my manuscript in, I had done that. So I was very pleased that they picked it up and thought it was worth using in the book. They worked really hard on this cover because it was not an easy book to illustrate. There have been other books I've written where it's just obvious what to put on the cover. You write a book called The Sugar House, they're going to put Domino Sugar, which is a well-known feature of the Baltimore Harbor landscape, on the cover of the book. Write a book about Edgar Allan Poe and you put his grave on the cover. That's a no-brainer, but this one was really hard.
Well, something too about water on covers, you know, swimming pools, beaches, I don't know, it's just something about it. And then there are the footprints and sort of glossy.
Yes, and that's a really wonderful touch because they picked up on the disappearing footprints of that first page.
Yeah. Getting back to what we were just talking about in terms of revising, I read in your, I guess something on Slate, your Slate diary possibly, that you said, once the first draft is done, I believe most crime writers spend subsequent drafts making simple stories seem complicated. Can you go a bit more into that in terms of, you know, layering, texturing a story so that, you know, you have something very simple that you're starting with and now you're going back? I mean, can you just talk about that a bit?
Sure, I'm happy to. Sort of the opposite of what you do as a reporter. As a reporter, you try to come up with the key and salient elements and put them in a concise, comprehensible lead so that people know right away what happened. And as a crime writer, you're always trying to obscure what's going on. There's usually a pretty simple explanation for what's happening in a book. As I mentioned, my first book, Baltimore Blues, a man was killed because something he did that he considered to be a good deed was seen as being tragic and horrible by the offended party. But I put a lot of stuff in front of that. And, you know, people call them red herrings, blind alleys. You know, part of crime fiction is reminding people that we often see what we look for, and we often find what we expect to find. And part of what a protagonist in a crime novel does is go on journeys where they have to confront different possibilities, different answers. I'm really fascinated by the way in life in general, when we don't know the facts, we tend to come up with a narrative that makes sense to us. And one of the things in Every Secret Thing is that when the two little girls, Ronnie and Alice, leave this birthday party at the swim club, there's been an incident in which Ronnie has said a horrible, horrible racial epithet. And later, they will end up taking and end up killing a child who happens to be black. And of course, in everyone's mind, A is connected to B. And that's a very common sense deduction to make. But as people who read the book find out, it's not that simple. Those two facts may look as if they're related, but maybe they're not. Maybe race doesn't actually have anything to do with the crime. Or maybe, on the other hand, as the mother of the victim would argue, when you're black in Baltimore, race has everything to do with every day of your life. And I just always felt that crime stories are better, actually. And there's some really good books out there that are super twisty, and you're just breathless at the end of them. But the ones I happen to prefer are ones where there actually really is a pretty simple explanation, but it's been obscured primarily by people's unwillingness to open their minds up to every possibility.
Yeah, that's interesting. Many of your novels, I imagine, were written while you were working at The Sun. How did you do that? You had a full-time job at the Baltimore Sun, and you wrote all these books. What'd you do?
I sometimes think I did it by not thinking about what I was doing. And really, until I stopped, I had no idea how hard I was working. I wrote 7 books while working full-time. And I wrote those first 7 books in 8 years. There's actually kind of a gap because it takes so long to find an agent and sell my first book that I'm almost done my second book by the time it happens. And then after that, I wrote a book a year while working full-time up through 2001. I got up at 6 o'clock every morning. I wrote for 2 hours, got in the shower, I went to work. I am a morning person. That helped. And I took the old adage about paying yourself first, you know, the advice you're given when you're trying to save money.
Sure.
In my case, what I needed was time. So I gave myself the first 2 hours of the day. That was time that I gave to myself. There was one year, 1998, where there was a mix-up about the production schedule for my book. And contractually, it was not due until January 1. But the reality was that if I didn't turn it in by October 1, they weren't going to be able to publish it when they wanted to, and there was just going to be a whole domino effect of problems. So I got up every morning at 6, and I worked for 2 hours. And then I went to work, and I came home, and I worked for another 2 hours. And in the middle of this, I was told that I was going to be assigned to the team covering the governor's race in Maryland. And on top of that, I was teaching at Johns Hopkins, a commitment I had made before I knew I was going to have to turn my book in early. And that was really hard. That was really hard. And I have to say, over a short period of time, people can do almost anything. I don't really recommend anyone going 7 years without a real vacation, which I think is pretty much what I did. That, you know, when I had a week off, I was either writing or I was on the road promoting my own books. Mm-hmm. And that really takes a toll. And then when I found myself in the position of being able to write full time, that was the year I wrote Every Secret Thing. My editor at Morrow has asked me, are those two things connected? Did you write this book because you no longer had to work full-time and you were feeling that you could be more adventurous? And I think it was connected, but in a different way, which is freed from my day job. I didn't want to be complacent or lazy, so I said, okay, now you have to do something hard. You have to do something you don't know how to do. Make the process chaotic again. Rediscover the terror that... Actually, it's always pretty near the surface whenever I start a book, but I really wanted to shake myself up. And so that's part of the reason I wrote Every Secret Thing as well, in order to make sure that the process would continue to be chaotic. And I found when I went back this year and began working on a new test book that that was chaotic again, and I no longer felt complacent at all.
Interesting. Do you still write in a cafe?
Yes, I do.
Will you talk about that?
When I was, when I found myself at home with this lovely office and everything I always wanted, which was to work at home, work for myself, but you know, it's really lonely and it can make you really antisocial. In the year that I was writing Every Secret Thing, I would go straight to work after having like a glass of orange juice and coffee at home, and I would work in my PJs. And sometimes it would be 1 o'clock and I would still be in my pajamas and I'd be kind of, you know, grimy and dirty. And I just thought, this isn't healthy. There's just something not quite right about this. And maybe I need to get out a little bit more. So I began getting up and taking a shower and carrying my laptop down to a coffee house in my neighborhood. I don't think it's incidental that I did this right around the time that Baltimore had this horrible blizzard. So everyone was feeling a little stir crazy anyway. And what I found out is that there's no phone at the coffee house, and there's no email.
Mm-hmm.
And it has kind of that nice murmur that I remember from newsrooms, so I feel very much at home, just sitting in a place where other people are talking, and phones ring, and things happen, but no one's asking for my attention. And it's a place where I can just focus utterly. And I do. So I still go down there almost every day. I was there this morning working on a short story.
That's interesting. There are so many distractions at home.
Mm.
So many.
I found that most people who work at home develop a mania for doing laundry. It's just so satisfying to get up and run downstairs and put another load in. And maybe sponge off that kitchen counter and then maybe rearrange the fridge. You know, there's just... There's nothing else for me to do when I'm sitting in the coffee house except write. I can glance at a newspaper. You know, I can procrastinate a little bit, but most of my procrastination tools are not available to me when I'm there.
Hmm. And I read also that you volunteered a soup kitchen.
Yes, I do.
Talk about that. Why do you do it?
Again, I wanted to get out of the house more. And I also felt I was in a position to give something back to the community. I had covered social services early in my career at The Sun, and I knew about this particular soup kitchen. And I knew the people who run it, Brendan Walsh and his wife, Willa. And I really like them. I think they're doing terrific work. I have to say, I never expected to love volunteering there as much as I do. The other volunteers are all terrific. I've gotten to know them. They're just good, nice, wonderful, funny, intelligent people. And it's a window on that hometown I love so much, on a particular section of it, Southwest Baltimore, one of the more integrated parts of town. It's one of the few places that you go in Baltimore where you see a pretty even distribution of black and white people. And there are a lot of people there who come through who have pretty severe drug problems. They're working men who don't make enough money to buy themselves lunch every day, who drive over in their trucks to just get a nice hot lunch. And and there are many times when I'm working there that Brendan like seats a family of eight at my table, and he'll sort of roll his eyes and say, "Oh, there's your next novel." But people often don't have the luxury of time that it takes to volunteer. It's not incidental that many of the people I meet volunteering are people who are retired, because you can't do it if you have a full-time job. And while I consider my writing life full-time, I certainly have an afternoon a week that I can carve out to give to Viva House, and I'm really happy to do it.
Sure. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Laura Lippman, author of Every Secret Thing, published by William Morrow. And you have a gorgeous website. Let's give the address. It's just so gorgeous. I love that view of Baltimore.
Thank you. That's www.lauralippman.com, and the website is really the brainchild of a fan, Beth Tendell, who lives in Cincinnati and with her husband runs a little part-time company called cincinnatimedia.com, wrote me one day and said, "You should have a website. Let me show you what I can do for you." And it's really been a great collaboration, and Beth has encouraged me to add fresh content to the site monthly, which is quite a commitment, I have to say. Every month I find myself facing that deadline, and I think, oh, Lord. But it's a great tool. It's just wonderful because people can email me, and the level of fan interest and attention that I just don't think there's any way that writers got this kind of feedback when there wasn't email.
Right.
And sometimes it can be overwhelming. Sometimes I think, oh, my Lord. But for the most part, the letters are just so wonderful. And I can't begin to describe how many terrific emails I get every week from people who just like the books or really more and more people who just respond to the website. Someone wrote me this week and said, "Oh, I'm going out to buy The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime because you said you liked it." Oh, wow. I said, "And write me back as soon as you do, because there's something I want to talk about that's kind of a spoiler in you. I need to find someone who's read the book who will talk about it with me."
Oh, yeah, that's great. And we're at the end of our time. I wonder if in the last minute we have, if you have any words of advice for the writers listening?
I do, and I'm stealing them. I'm stealing them from another writer, Larry Block. You should always write what you want to write, because then if it does really well, you have the satisfaction of enjoying commercial success because of something that was heartfelt. And then if commercial success doesn't come along, well, at least you did what you wanted to do. I just tell people to put their heads down and keep their eyes on their own paper and to really lose themselves in the process of the writing, which is frustrating and can make you crazy, but it's also really joyous. And if it's not ultimately joyous, then something's wrong.
Hmm. I thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having
me. Show. You've been a delight, and continued great wishes on this book.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That was Laura Lippman speaking to us from Baltimore, Maryland. And again, her website is www.lauralippman.com. And that's LIPPMAN.com. Do check out the website. It's just beautiful. And in any case, if you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website, which is not as beautiful, but will give you some info. And that's writersonwriting.com. From there, you can email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. And I would like to leave you with a quote by Octavia Butler, who said, "Writing is one of the few professions in which you can psychoanalyze yourself, get rid of hostilities and frustrations in public, and get paid for it." What could be better? Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. Stay tuned for Between the Lines, and I'll see you here next week.